Welcome to the New York Times Primal Scream Line, where the floor is yours to yell, laugh, cry, or vent for a solid minute.
I just wanted to say...
Honestly, that could have been me screaming, or one of the many hundreds of parents who've contacted us here at The Takeaway over the past several months to share their stories. You see, the pandemic is just too hard on working parents, especially working mothers. I mean, it's so hard that the New York Times set up a hotline to give parents an outlet to vent. And it's the centerpiece of a series called The Primal Scream. Here's some more of what moms who called into the Times hotline had to say.
I cannot remember the last time I did not worry. I did not spend my day worrying about so much stuff. Every day is something different. I just want to wake up and go through my day and not worry and not wonder and not know what the future holds, because this right here sucks and I'm sick of it. I'm so sick.
I'm gonna lose my mind if something doesn't happen soon.
There is just so much talking all the time, all day long, words. All I hear all the live long day is mom.
Well, we hear you, moms, and some dads, and we know that you need help. So today we're going to ask what role employers and the government should have in making this situation at least sustainable. Let's all scream together, shall we? We're going to get to that today on The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. Claire Kane Miller is a correspondent for The New York Times covering gender, families, and the future of work. Hey, Claire.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Also with us is Joan C. Williams, the director of the Center for Work-Life Law and a professor at the University of California, Hastings Law. And her center started a free legal advice helpline last April. Joan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Delighted to be here.
Joan, when the calls started coming in, were women, what was the change, if you say, that you started to see during the course of the pandemic?
Well, we've had a sevenfold increase in calls to our hotlines. So the changes were dramatic. I mean, women's whole infrastructure for taking care of children just absolutely disappeared overnight in many cases. And so they were just at wit's end. First, they had nothing. Then they had what's called the Families First Coronavirus Response Act that gave them the right to 12 weeks of leave if they had no childcare or their child's school was closed. But, you know, single moms, they couldn't afford to take the leave. And so they were making really hard choices. And even partnered moms very often couldn't afford to take the leave. But the first wave of calls were for the many, many women who could and did take the leave. But then those leaves disappeared on December 31st. So we are dealing with calls, the same kinds of calls that we've been dealing with all along, women who are pregnant, who are very apprehensive about going back to work because the science around pregnancy and COVID is basically very, very nascent. Women who were working remotely and wanted to continue, but whose employers refused to have them continue. Women who were really worried because there was a fragile person in their household who, if they got COVID, whether it was a child or an elder, were likely to get severe forms of COVID. So they wanted to telework, and sometimes their employers would not let them telework. Now we hear lots of so-called COVID layoffs, which I was just reading one case. The only two people laid off in the entire company were the plaintiff who was pregnant and another woman who was on maternity leave.
We're going to get into some of the specifics here, Joan, on some of the legal issues that those that raises. But I want to bring in Claire here. Claire, you were part of this New York Times project, and you wrote a piece where you mentioned Betsy Stevenson, who's an economist at the University of Michigan. I want to quote what she said. She said, quote, "People talk about how moms can lift a car off their children, but even though you can do it, it doesn't mean you didn't do damage to your body when lifting the car." Really good point. What is the cost to working moms right now, Claire, who are dealing with this, if that's our metaphor?
I think it's a generational hit to, you know, women in the labor force and earning their own incomes. We had just right before the pandemic hit, crossed the 50% line. Women held more than half of non-farm jobs, which is the way they measure it in this country. And now, you know, both men and women's employment has been hurt by this recession, of course. But when you look individually at parents, mothers have been hurt much more than fathers. And of course, it's not just income. It's also mental health, as one of the people on the Screamline said, just, you know, constant anxiety about your kids. It's all of it.
I'm wondering what you're seeing, generally speaking, about caregivers, whether or not they're being penalized by their employers, because that level of stress, and I mean, I've experienced it, a lot of parents are experiencing it, you can't help but having that have an effect on your job. So are women being given, generally speaking, the ability to sort of manage that, or are they afraid that they could lose their jobs?
At the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of employers gave people the ability to shift their hours or work flexibly. And, you know, that was a great response at the beginning. It's not a great response a year in. What it has meant is that people are working nights and weekends. They're waking up before dawn. Maybe that worked last March for a month. It doesn't work for a year. It means they're just doing double the amount of work. For essential workers, maybe they've shifted their schedules around that of their co-parents, so the two parents never see one another. They're like ships in the night. It's really not enough to understand that people need to work at different hours. What needs to be understood is that if you have caregiving responsibilities, it is a complete and total second job that you have going on inside your house, and you can't be expected to do both. And employers, some have said that they will not penalize working parents, that they'll understand. And, you know, it's not just parents here. Everybody's been stressed about COVID. People have gotten sick. People are caring for elder relatives. They've said they'll not penalize them in some cases. In other cases, as Joan mentioned, they already are being penalized. And it's hard to know, as we all know on this call and on this show today, that women were penalized for their additional caregiving responsibilities even in normal times. So it's hard to imagine when it comes time for hiring or reviews that employers won't look at these resume gaps or this decrease in productivity and penalize women in some way.
Joan, the federal government under the Trump administration did issue some protections for parents under the Family First Coronavirus Response Act. That expired on December 31st. That afforded me, for example, the ability to take a couple of days and care for my child. But it is now expired. Who was left out and why, Joan?
Who is left out is basically everybody. I mean, Biden has a proposal that would bring the leave back and actually enhance it. But now mothers, and this is true of fathers too, but really, I call it the great COVID cop-out. Mothers have been left holding the bag in a very, very huge way.
And Joan, what, is that because we as women are expected to hold the bag, or do we as women expect to hold the bag?
It's complicated at some level, and at some level, it's not complicated at all. Men know if they don't do it, women will, and women know if they don't do it, no one will. There's a forthcoming study that shows something really dramatic, which is that when the mom is the only one working remote, surprise, surprise, she does a lot more of the household tasks. But when the dad is the only one working remote, he doesn't do more childcare. So people often say, oh, this is just mother's hormones or mother's priorities or mother's choices. But actually, no, its widely held expectations, really two sets. One is that the ideal worker is someone who is always available for work. And that just means we define the ideal worker as somebody else who has someone who has somebody else, typically a woman, taking care of everything outside of work. That job description is typically not available for women. So we have the ideal worker defined as someone who's always available for work, and the ideal mother is someone who's always available to her children. That's what lands us in this situation again and again and again.
You were starting, Joan, to talk a little bit about Biden's plan, and I would like to hear a little bit about what you think so far. You said it's going to be enhanced. How so?
Okay. The Biden plan would be great. It would bring back the leave. This is the first time in American history we've had national paid family leave. And the first time that I'm aware of that we've had leave for just because you just don't have childcare. So this would bring back the leaves that are available to people whose childcares are closed, whose schools are remote, and it would increase the amount of leave up to 14 weeks of leave. And also, very importantly, as the first set of leaves, the Families First Coronavirus Response Act leaves, the ones that just ended, those excluded 106 million people originally, as interpreted by the Trump administration. And these new leaves, the Biden plan, would not exclude anything like that number of people. So it would be very, very important to get these leaves back for people.
Claire, we've got about 40 seconds left, but I'm curious, does this proposal appear to be on its way to make it through?
It's unclear. The Democrats are working very hard to push it through as quickly as possible. And there is a lot, in fact, of bipartisan support for paid leave. His proposal includes a lot of other things like money for families, like retirement help for women who have had to take career pauses. It's unclear if it will all make it through, but paid leave does seem to have support.
Joan, you wanted to bring up the issue of anxiety that many mothers are experiencing right now. Tell us about that.
Well, mothers should realize that they have quite a lot of legal rights. If your employer is discriminating against you because you're a mom, that's illegal. And people who are extremely anxious also may well have rights under the Americans with Disabilities Act, because that's a disability. So not only can an employer not discriminate against you because you have anxiety, but you're entitled to workplace accommodations if you have anxiety. And those accommodations may include getting leave from your job. This is completely different from the leaves we've been talking about. This is an Americans with Disabilities Act accommodation. And we have been hearing from mothers who, as Claire pointed out, are in a wild state of anxiety. And then many people who had anxiety conditions even before COVID and before this whole mess. And that's one of the contexts in which you have rights to leave.
Claire, one of the things that's come up in this issue, obviously, is childcare. A lot of mothers have decided to leave their jobs to fill the childcare gap, but obviously that's not an option for all mothers. What kinds of policies, Claire, are you seeing that would help fill that childcare gap? One of the things that I've called for in a recent piece in the Washington Post that I wrote was calling for the Biden-Harris administration to create some sort of national childcare system. Is that even a possibility?
It's something that a lot of Democratic policymakers have wanted to see well before COVID. And like so many things, COVID has just laid bare some of the crises that people in the United States are facing. I think one of the important things for people to realize is that the things that would help people in normal times, like paid leave for short periods, aren't necessarily the most important thing right now. For example, when you have a new baby, or maybe when you have a relative who's in hospice, you need a short period of time away from work, you know, relatively short, to care for that person. This has gone on for a year. 12 weeks of paid leave is definitely necessary for a lot of people. I'm not saying it's not necessary, but people need more than 12 weeks. Schools continue to be closed. Child care centers continue to be closed or unavailable, or parents don't feel they're safe. And what can really help there is money. A lot of the women that we've talked to and that we've seen surveyed nationally say they don't actually want to leave work, or they can't leave work. And in that case, what they need is money to find childcare elsewhere. Maybe it's a neighbor, maybe it is going to a daycare or hiring an in-home care provider. People who didn't have nannies before are looking at nannies right now because that would really help. That would decrease the contacts in your family, help with the virus. But of course, many people can't afford that. So, you know, the government plans that would actually just send checks to parents, as well as employers who are finding ways to subsidize childcare, to me, that seems like one of the most effective policies that we could see right now.
And let's talk a little bit about the differences here between how race is factoring into this. And you mentioned, you know, there's also partners, people with partners, single parents, there are low income women. Joan, how do each of these groups fare in this? And what are the different challenges? Because as a single parent myself, I feel like the options are not as available to me to stop working, even if it's for a short amount of time.
Absolutely. And this has reinforced both racial hierarchies and gender hierarchies in a very, very big way. We hear so often from single moms, and I mean, some of them are in the situation where they have to choose between whether to put food on the table and leave really small kids, 6, 8-year-olds, home alone. Those are the kinds of choices that single moms are often facing. And of course, anything that has a differential on differential effect on single moms has a differential effect by race, because 2/3 of Black moms, for example, are single moms. One of the things that we focused on in talking so far about leave is that often people want other accommodations. They don't want leave. For example, I remember reading a case of one single mom, and she just wanted couple of hours a day to supervise the remote schooling, and her employer was refusing to give that. That's one of the things that the Families First leaves gave people, is the ability to take leave in short segments for an hour a day or whatever they wanted. And if the leave comes back, they'll also have that. But there are other reasons why people might be able to have an demand an accommodation for remote work. And we hear all the time from people on our hotlines who have been working remotely effectively, and then their employers order everybody back to work, and they say, you know, do I have any legal rights? And it's a complicated question. If you're in that situation, you should definitely call the hotline, but you may have legal rights if you're being treated more harshly than workers who aren't moms because you're a mom. That is sex discrimination, and you don't have to put up with that. But in terms of the class impacts and the racial impacts, they're really dramatic.
Joan C. Williams is the director of the Center for Work-Life Law and a professor at the University of California Hastings Law. And Claire Kane Miller is a correspondent for The New York Times covering gender, families, and the future of work. Claire and Joan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Nina, and I'm from Bellingham, Washington. I'm a new parent to a baby, and I just feel like, you know, a really important thing this year has been my company just understanding time off and crazy things coming up. My baby has gotten sick a number of times, and she's in daycare. So every time she has a fever, my husband or I have to take work off and go and pick her up and watch her, or, you know, get my mother to come into town and watch her. And that's been really difficult because babies have fevers for all sorts of reasons, you know, and they get runny noses and little coughs and stuff. And, you know, she's not even one yet. She's already been tested for COVID twice. But honestly, my company has been really, really helpful and understanding and supportive in the midst of all of that. And I really appreciate them.
Another conversation we've been having this week was about universal basic income, and we talked about how that can be an option for families dealing with the economic hardship of the pandemic. One of you had a global take on that.
Francina, I love your show. This is Holly calling from Silver Spring, Maryland. I'm both excited and exhausted by the reporting and the debates that I hear about the use of cash transfers to meet the needs of Americans affected by the economic impacts of COVID-19. I work in international humanitarian aid, and I'm a specialist in the use of cash and voucher assistance. We in international humanitarian aid use cash transfers and vouchers to help crisis-affected populations meet their basic and their midterm needs. All evidence shows that when cash transfers are well-targeted and given in a timely manner, they can be the most effective way to deliver aid. And they're also more dignified, as people are allowed to decide on where they need to invest most, as opposed to someone telling them what to do.
Keep making your voice a part of our show, folks. You can record a voice memo on your phone and email it to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. It's really easy. I was even able to make one this weekend when I read about our next story about a new congressional report that has found significant levels of heavy metals like arsenic and lead in many baby foods. Scary stuff. So here's how I felt after I read the news. I now am in my kitchen. I'm recording this memo from my kitchen as I begin to throw away many of the food items that I bought for my child. And they have ingredients like kale and spinach and other things that are supposed to be good for our children. And unfortunately, carrots and blueberries and all of these wonderful things, and I'm dumping out and I know I'm sure I'm not alone when I say that parents right now are probably reading this and just like me thinking, what do you do now? So this is something I want to explore on our show. Some of the country's leading baby food brands, including Gerber, Earth's Best Organic, and Beech Nut, have significant levels of toxic heavy metals and chemicals like arsenic, lead, and mercury in their products. That's according to a new report from congressional investigators who examined a range of baby food products, from rice cereals to fruit and vegetable purees. For years now, the federal government has had minimal regulations monitoring the safety of baby food, despite the negative health effects on these heavy metals on infants and toddlers. Laura Riley is a business of food reporter at the Washington Post. Laura, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Tanzina.
So why are there heavy metals like lead and chemicals like arsenic in so many of these products?
Couple reasons. So reason number one, a lot of these toxic metals, heavy metals, occur naturally in soil and in water. Additionally, some of this is due to the fact that a lot of baby foods have additives, things like minerals and vitamin mixes that contain these heavy metals.
And so is this naturally occurring, or is it occurring because of something that there's no oversight on, or is it because the soil is toxic? Like, how is this happening?
Well, it's a lack of oversight, clearly. The FDA at this point has a maximum level of arsenic for a single type of baby food, for, you know, rice cereal. Basically, they say it's 100 parts per billion, but everything else lacks a maximum heavy metal count. So it's very unclear why that has not, you know, we have maximum lead for bottled water, for other products, for candies. So why not baby food is a big question.
You said for candies? You said for candy? There are maximum and there aren't for baby food. Laura, I have a baby, so I'm sitting here going, how is that possible?
Well, it's certainly a question. I mean, there are oversight committees that clearly have been falling down on the job with this particular issue. So is it reasonable to say, okay, henceforth, these heavy metals, whether it's lead or arsenic or cadmium, we're tolerating 0% of them in baby foods. Well, maybe not. I mean, it might mean that a baby food container is $20 for one of those little 3-ounce jars. So we have to strongly urge the FDA to set levels that are safe. And that, you know, that's a big question. I think today, as a matter of fact, the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, sent out a letter urging the FDA to take swift action on this, you know, in light of this subcommittee's report this past week.
What shocked me about this is that, you know, these included major brands like Gerber, brands that a lot of parents like myself are purchasing, thinking they're doing the right thing because they're, quote unquote, organic, USDA organic. Like, where is the disconnect between something being labeled as organic and something, that same product, having high levels of toxic metals?
Well, a lot of these companies, they don't produce the ingredients that go into their products, right? Let's say something like Campbell's, which makes Plum baby foods. So they buy in ingredients from all over the place, and they have to trust, you know, they don't have the wherewithal or, you know, infrastructure to test every single ingredient coming into their warehouse. So those ingredients come from, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds of different purveyors, from, you know, the carrots to the herbs to the, you know, salt to everything that goes into those jars. And so they're kind of trusting that their subcontractors are testing appropriately. And then we are anticipating that these companies, whether it's, you know, BeechNut or Gerber or, you know, Sprout Organics, is testing their finished products. And I think that that is just not happening.
Laura, there were other major manufacturers, like you mentioned earlier, Campbell's Soup and Walmart and others, that did not participate in this congressional investigation. Why was that? Do we know?
Well, we don't know. So I did talk to people at Campbell's and at Walmart, and they said, well, we didn't give this oversight subcommittee our data, but we did respond to their questions. So I think
that doesn't seem fair, Laura, does it?
Exactly. But the presumption of guilt is, you know, it's a tricky thing.
Okay.
You know, to me, the bigger issue is, what would safe levels look like? I mean, the thing about babies, you know, in a perfect world, pediatricians say a baby should have nothing but breast milk until 4 months, right? And then you slowly start introducing things. And by the time they're 9 months or a year old, they're eating, you know, dozens of, like us, dozens and dozens of things. And the cumulative effect of a metal like lead or arsenic is the issue. But if you're eating carrots from over here and, you know, cereals from over here, it is a real question. How much is too much? That, you know, when can you start worrying about an infant's neurological development with some of these metals?
Well, let's talk about that, because I spent the weekend throwing away puffs and teething crackers that had rice flour in them. I threw away, must have been, 3 containers and a couple more containers of crackers. Are we talking about products like this, everything from the purees to the puffs?
Well, I think that rice has been a problematic ingredient because of the way it's grown. It often has arsenic that's leached into it. So, I mean, I'm not going to say avoid rice, but I would be a little more cautious about an ingredient like that. But, you know, these toxins were found in a real range of products, from green veg to sweet potato to juices to those puffs. Although I will say, with the puffs, a lot of pediatricians that I've talked to say that those are a product, all of these kind of toddler foods, the kind of foods that go in between infant foods and, you know, normal people foods, are a solution to a problem that doesn't exist. That a lot of those foods are not medically necessary or advisable, that you're really in a better position if you go from baby, you know, breast milk baby food or formula, whichever, you know, you choose, then into kind of normal people food chopped up small, you know, that rather than doing these kind of cheese puff adjacent foods. So obviously, unfortunately, there are tons of parents out there getting hysterical right now saying, okay, that's it, I'm going to make my own baby food. You know, there's no saying that some of the vegetables that you source at the grocery store don't also contain some of these. So I think really what we need is legislation and the baby food companies to get together with the FDA to establish safe limits across you know, across all of these different metals.
Laura, I mean, but that just seems like it should have been done decades ago when baby food was introduced to consumers. And it's supposed to be a convenience, I think, for many people who, you know, like myself, are working parents who are thinking, you know, this says organic and this is coming from a brand that's reputable. And, you know, it's supposed to be safe for my kid and it saves me the trouble of having to make a meal. Then why not? You know, and it just feels like an absolute I just don't understand why these three entities have not come together yet, given that this can have health effects for children. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. I mean, another thing to consider is a lot of the brands that were named in this study are the brands that are available to Americans who are on WIC, you know, the food subsidy for women and children, women and babies and toddlers. So the idea that we are saying to these people, yes, you know, you're food insecure, here you go. Here are the brands from which you can choose, you know, to feed your baby. And these are the ones that actually have tested high for some of these heavy metals. So it's to me, it's kind of redoubling the outrage factor.
Laura, is there a baby food lobby? And I'm not joking about that question.
Well, there is an organization that's kind of come together fairly recently. I think it's called the Baby Food Alliance. And their objective is to do precisely this. It's a Baby Food Council, actually, is what it's called. So their goal, I mean, maybe they're a little bit, you know, late to the table on this, but their goal is to have science-based standards that food suppliers can impose the industry. And this seems imperative given this the study findings.
Let's give parents some solutions to, you sort of alluded to that earlier, but what are some things that parents can do right now to reduce the metals and the toxins that some of these baby foods carry? Should they be looking for specific brands? Should they be staying away from specific products? Should they, as you mentioned earlier, attempt to make their own? I gave my kid for the first time spaghetti and sauce yesterday, and that was a win. So What are your recommendations?
There are tons of new baby foods on the market that, you know, there are those kind of subscription services and ones where their sourcing is really, really exacting. But those really are predicated on having the financial, you know, having your wallet accommodate that. You know?
They're not cheap.
I mean, they're not cheap. They really aren't. Some of these subscription services where food kind of, you know, kind of HelloFresh-like comes to your house, they're expensive. You can always make your own. I would suggest breadth of options. I mean, this is good for every baby just in terms of developing a broad palate, you know, but don't stick in a narrow lane. Try to vary what they eat widely for a number of reasons, but also because then you're kind of spreading around, you know, you're minimizing a risk if you're, you know, rather than just eating one particular, you know, sweet potatoes and carrots or, you know, that kind of thing. And I would watch the rice. I think that that's something, you know, gravitate towards other grains if possible, as long as there's not a, you know, any indication of allergies there. But I think that also just urge legislators to look into this. So this is going to be something that is going to require the outrage of parents across the country to really move the needle on.
We'll be following this story. Laura Riley is the Business of Food reporter for The Washington Post. Laura, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In the late 1960s, Fred Hampton, chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers, galvanized residents of Chicago by championing programs aimed at economic justice, including a free breakfast program for children. In 1969, Hampton was killed by police officers in a raid on his apartment, and he was only 21 years old. Here he is speaking to a crowd in a clip from the 1971 documentary, The Murder of Fred Hampton.
Bobby Seale is going through all types of physical and mental torture. But that's all right, because we said even before this happened, and we're going to say it after this, and after I'm locked up, and after everybody's locked up, that you can jail a revolutionary, but you can't jail a revolution. Bang.
This week, Hampton's story is being brought to an even bigger audience through the movie Judas and the Black Messiah, which is out on Friday on HBO Max. Directed by Shaka King, the film depicts Hampton through the eyes of William O'Neill, an FBI informant who infiltrated the Black Panthers and supplied federal agents with information that led to the killing of Hampton. Brothers Keith and Kenny Lucas are two of the writers behind Judas and the Black Messiah. And they're perhaps best known for their comedy work, but the Lucas brothers have also been working to bring the life of Fred Hampton to the screen for more than 6 years. Keith and Kenny, thanks for joining us on The Takeaway. How are you?
We're good. Hey, thanks for having us.
Oh, my God. I just have a question. Are you guys going to answer in harmony for all the questions? That's what we
want. We try to.
Okay, excellent. Excellent. Okay. Well, let me throw this one to Keith or Kenny. You first pitched Fred Hampton's story to film studios around 2014. It's now 2020/2021 film season. It took a lot of time to get the film made. Why is that?
I guess, a lot of capitalist studios weren't jumping for joy to tell a story about a black socialist. So, also, I don't want to speak for Kenny, but we weren't the best at pitching the story, too. So, it takes a while.
Speak for yourself. I was excellent. I think you nailed it the first time. They didn't want to buy a story about a black socialist.
Well, it's finally here, and the film centers around the FBI informant William O'Neill. Why, which is an interesting take here. Why did you guys decide to look at Hampton from his perspective?
I think we just felt like it would make for a more thrilling story from a cinematic perspective. I just felt like we had more to work with from that angle. While I think Hampton's story is fascinating, you can't separate it from the FBI and COINTELPRO. So I think if you're going to tell a big story like this, you might as well go all in.
And we also wanted to juxtapose William O'Neill with Fred Hampton. We thought that, at least philosophically, it would be interesting to see one person who was fully committed to a belief system and another person who was basically ambivalent about politics. We just thought the juxtaposition was a lot stronger. Hmm.
And you went from comedy to this film. And so how does this fit into, were you guys looking to broaden the range that you had, or did you find these two things were sort of compatible in some way?
We've always been pretty sad guys. I think I think comedy was just the first outlet that we could just sort of, grasp and have fun doing. But we always had intentions on trying more dramatic stuff just because it was an exercise that we wanted to, try.
Yeah, I've always been fascinated with tragedy. We used to study it in college. We studied Greek tragedy, and I think that was always an interest to us. How can we tell stories that employed elements of Greek tragedy?
We, on this show, talk a lot about the empathy gap in this country. And one of the things that you and I actually have in common is that we grew up in affordable housing / public housing in urban areas. I in New York, you guys in Newark, New Jersey. How did that experience shape your work? And is that an experience that has helped you open up to being empathetic and how people can build empathy for others?
Yeah, I would say that it was fundamental in our development. Just living in such entrenched poverty, you can't help but be more empathetic towards your fellow man because so much is so shared. You're concerned about their safety from a physical standpoint. You're concerned about the safety of your family from a a mental standpoint, and you grow very close with your kin. I would also say that growing up in that circumstance, you're sort of living in a war zone in a sense, and you develop sort of existential. I developed an existential take on a lot of things, and it certainly made me gravitate toward storytelling and philosophy, I would say.
And yeah, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, when you grow up in such conditions, it shapes your mind, and we developed PTSD because of how we grew up. And I think, you see that play out in a lot of the work that we make. We try to get inside the minds of our characters and why they make the decisions that they make. And it's in large part shaped by the conditions that they grow up in. And so I think you see that play out with O'Neill and Judas and the Black Messiah.
And it also, we've talked a lot about the power of comedy and humor on this show. And I wonder if that's also a way to sort of deal with, as you described it. And it's interesting, I've described it that way myself, growing up in that systemic and entrenched poverty can have long-lasting effects.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, comedy was a refuge for us. I mean, without it, I don't think we would have survived. I mean, it's like being able to laugh in spite of being in such tough conditions. It's just like, again, it's a way to get through it. Now, I wouldn't over rely on comedy. I think people should get therapy if they can afford it, et cetera. But, you know, without being able to afford therapy, like, comedy is like the next best thing.
Yeah, I would say comedy is like that first line of defense against sort of those issues, those debilitating psychological issues. It provides you like that instant relief, and it's free. Obviously, you have to, you know, get more scientific as you get older. But when you're really young, it's a refuge, as my brother said.
Do you suspect that, I'm wondering, we're asking a lot of our guests during the pandemic if they're finding room for joy in a very difficult moment. We've got 1 minute left, 30 seconds for both of you. What's bringing each of you joy?
Being able to be with my brother, be with my girlfriend, to spend the time with, you know, the family that I can't spend time with, that's bringing me the most joy.
Yeah, without a doubt, my family, my friends, and my dog.
Well, that's there you have it. Keith and Kenny Lucas are co-writers and co-producers for Judas and the Black Messiah. Keith, Kenny, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's a wrap for today, folks. We really hope you enjoyed the show. And of course, if you have any thoughts or ideas for the show, send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. I'm at Tanzina Vega. And we can also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or give us a call the old-fashioned way at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Leave us your take there. Thanks as always for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and we'll see you tomorrow.